In the inevitable jangle of these incompatibles, the Church had become dogmatic. In despair of other solutions to its intellectual discords, it had resorted to arbitrary authority. Its priests and bishops were more and more men moulded to creeds and dogmas and set procedures. By the time they became cardinals or popes, they were usually oldish men, habituated to a politic struggle for immediate ends and no longer capable of worldwide views. They no longer wanted to see the kingdom of God established in the hearts of men. They had forgotten about that. They wanted to see the power of the Church, which was their own power, dominating men. They were prepared to bargain even with the hates and fears and lusts in men's hearts to ensure that power. And it was just because many of them probably doubted secretly of the entire soundness of their vast and elaborate doctrinal fabric that they would brook no discussion of it. They were intolerant of questions or dissent, not because they were sure of their faith, but because they were not. They wanted conformity for reasons of policy. By the 13th century, the Church was evidently already morbidly anxious about the gnawing habits that might presently lay the whole structure of its pretensions in ruins. It had no serenity of soul. It was hunting everywhere for heretics, as timid old ladies are said to look under beds and in cupboards for burglars before retiring for the night. We've already mentioned the Persian Mani, who was crucified and flayed in the year 277. His way of representing the struggle between good and evil was as a struggle between a power of light which was, as it were, in rebellion against a power of darkness inherent in the universe. All these profound mysteries are necessarily represented by symbols and poetic expressions, and the ideas of Mani still find a response in many intellectual temperaments today. One may hear Manichaean doctrines from many Christian pulpits, but the Orthodox Catholic symbol was a different one. These Manichaean ideas had spread very widely in Europe, and particularly in Bulgaria and the south of France. In the south of France, the people who held them were called the Cathars or Albigenses. Their ideas jarred so little with the essentials of Christianity that they believed themselves to be devout Christians. As a body, they lived lives of conspicuous virtue and purity in a violent, undisciplined, and vicious age, but they questioned the doctrinal soundness of Rome and the Orthodox interpretation of the Bible. They thought Jesus was a rebel against the cruelty of the God of the Old Testament, and not his harmonious son. Closely associated with the Albigenses were the Waldenses, the followers of a man called Waldo, who seems to have been quite soundly Catholic in his theology, but equally offensive to the Church because he denounced the riches and luxury of the clergy. This was enough for the Lateran, and so we have the spectacle of Innocent III preaching a crusade against these unfortunate sectaries, and permitting the enlistment of every wandering scoundrel at loose ends to carry fire and sword and rape and every conceivable outrage among the most peaceful subjects of the King of France. The accounts of the cruelties and abominations of this crusade are far more terrible to read than any account of Christian martyrdoms by the pagans, and they have the added horror of being indisputably true. This black and pitiless intolerance was an evil spirit to be mixed into the project of a rule of God on earth. This was a spirit entirely counter to that of Jesus of Nazareth. We don't hear of his smacking the faces or wringing the wrists of recalcitrant or unresponsive disciples. But the popes, during their centuries of power, were always raging against the slightest reflection upon the intellectual sufficiency of the Church. And the intolerance of the Church was not confined to religious matters. The shrewd, pompous, irascible, and rather malignant old men who manifestly constituted a dominant majority in the councils of the Church, resented any knowledge but their own knowledge, and distrusted any thought at all that they didn't correct and control. They set themselves to restrain science, of which they were evidently jealous. Any mental activity but their own struck them as being insolent. Later on, they were to have a great struggle upon the question of the Earth's position in space, and whether it moved round the sun or not. This was really not the business of the Church at all. She might very well have let to reason the things that are reasons, but she seems to have been impelled by an inner necessity to estrange the intellectual conscience in men. Had this intolerance sprung from a real intensity of conviction, it would have been bad enough, but it was accompanied by a scarcely disguised contempt for the intelligence and mental dignity of the common man that makes it far less acceptable to our modern judgments, and which no doubt made it far less acceptable to the free spirits of the time. We've told quite dispassionately the policy of the Roman Church towards her troubled sister in the East. Many of the tools and expedients she used were abominable. In her treatment of her own people, a streak of real cynicism is visible. She destroyed her prestige by disregarding her own teaching of righteousness. Of dispensations, we've already spoken. Her crowning folly in the 16th century was the sale of indulgences, whereby the sufferings of the soul in purgatory could be commuted for a money payment. But the spirit that led at last to this shameless and, as it proved, disastrous proceeding was already very evident in the 12th and 13th centuries. Long before the seed of criticism that Frederick II had sown had germinated in men's minds and produced its inevitable crop of rebellion, there was apparent a strong feeling in Christendom that all was not well with the spiritual atmosphere. There began movements that nowadays we should call revivalist within the Church, that implied rather than uttered a criticism of the sufficiency of her existing methods and organization. Men sought fresh forms of righteous living outside the monasteries and priesthood. One notable figure is that of St. Francis of Assisi, 1181 to 1226. We can't tell here in any detail of how this pleasant young gentleman gave up all the amenities and ease of his life and went forth to seek God. The opening of the story isn't unlike the early experiences of Gautama Buddha. He had a sudden conversion in the midst of a life of pleasure, and taking a vow of extreme poverty, he gave himself up to an imitation of the life of Christ, and to the service of the sick and wretched, and more particularly to the service of the lepers, who then abounded in Italy. He was joined by great multitudes of disciples, and so the first friars of the Franciscan order came into existence. An order of women devotees were set up beside the original confraternity, and in addition great numbers of men and women were brought into less formal association. He preached unmolested by the Moslems, be it noted, in Egypt and Palestine, though the Fifth Crusade was then in progress. His relations with the Church are still a matter for discussion. His work had been sanctioned by Pope Innocent III, but while he was in the East, there was a reconstitution of his order, intensifying its discipline and substituting authority for responsive impulse, and as a consequence of these changes, he resigned its headship. To the end, he clung passionately to the ideal of poverty, but he was hardly dead before the order was holding property through trustees, and building a great church and monastery to his memory at Assisi. The disciplines of the order that were applied after his death to his immediate associates are scarcely to be distinguished from a persecution. Several of the more conspicuous zealots for simplicity were scourged. Others were imprisoned. One was killed while attempting to escape, and Brother Bernard, the first disciple, passed a year in the woods and hills, hunted like a wild beast. This struggle within the Franciscan order is a very interesting one because it foreshadows the great troubles that were coming to Christendom,